All right, so we just kind of finished up with all the Salt City Hoops writers. We had Ben Dowsett on, we had Dan Clayton on, we had Clark Schmutz on. All gave their all-time Jazz starting fives. We've got those to kind of debate about later. But for now, we've got kind of an NBA voice. We've got a statistical voice. Seth Partnow, he's of Nylon Calculus, the Washington Post Fancy Stats blog, joins us now on the hotline to talk about the general NBA, what we learned in Summer League, that sort of thing. How are you, Seth?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We've had a fun show thus far. Ben's out of town, so it's just me asking you questions today. But, hopefully that works.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to talk to you first about something that you didn't write on Nylon Calculus, but showed up on there anyway this week, and I want to know if you agree about the Charlotte Hornets, and in particular, should they have taken the picks instead of Frank Kaminsky? Because that was kind of an option for the Jazz as well, as they tried to move up to try to take Justice Winslow. I don't think their package was as promising as the Celtics was. But should they have taken those kind of four first-round picks that either the Celtics or the Jazz offered a package as well to try to get Justice Winslow at nine and move down and kind of see what you can get with more players?
There's two kind of questions you're asking here. One is kind of the value of all those picks they were offered, and the other side is kind of specific to Frank Kaminsky. I can't claim to be completely objective on this just because to the extent that I have lingering fandom, it is of the Celtics. So there's kind of some lingering bitterness there that it's a great deal. Take it, please. And that didn't happen. But I think that from both standpoints, I'm not as high on Kaminsky as some people are. Yes, he's going to be a nice player. I think you'd rather kind of take four shots at a star rather than one shot at this guy who was, you know, an older player and great in the tournament and so on and so forth. So from that standpoint, if it were me, I would say yes, let's do it. Let's take one of those deals and kind of diversify our chances of really hitting with this.
Now, had they taken Winslow, do you say the same thing? I mean, because as a fan, you would want them to make that trade, right?
Sure. No, and that's an interesting question, whether I'd say that now or then. At the time, Winslow kind of changed the calculus a little bit. Now, having learned a little more about him and say mildly disappointing summer league by Winslow, kind of the pre-draft questions about kind of offensive skill set not totally answered, then I almost think that regardless, you trade down and take the more shots, and especially if kind of an unprotected future Brooklyn pick is involved.
Yeah,
you kind of have to like where that might be the best kind of asset of anything involved in the whole setup.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that that got like second or third mentioned by Zach Lowe, because to me that's the better asset rather than just the number 16 pick.
I think so, and I would say that's a better asset. You know, that as a future asset is better than a present asset. Once you kind of, I forget who used the analogy first, but it's, you know, a draft pick is nice and shiny, but once you drive the car off the lot, all of a sudden, you know, you put a name to it, and it's whether it's Frank Kaminsky or Justice Winslow, all of a sudden that's sort of less sexy than the idea of this future pot of gold.
Right. Speaking of Summer League and speaking of Justice Winslow's performance in it, what else did you learn from Summer League? I mean, who impressed for you? Who didn't impress? Did you notice any greater trends going on?
Oh, the one thing that really impressed me, I think, and a lot of people, was Emmanuel Mudiay was kind of the definite wow factor of Summer League. Was just his kind of his vision, his ability to penetrate and kind of get people open and then deliver on-time passes to shooters, and just seems like a star of the future for Denver. Obviously, there's concerns about the shooting, especially. His defense wasn't great, but that's a 19-year-old guard, and their defense tends to not be great. So, like, that you look past a little bit, but the shooting is a concern, but It's already improved from what people who knew him more in high school to say. So he was, you know, by good margin, the most impressive. And on the flip side, I'm a little worried about D'Angelo Russell. Again, very, very good vision, passing skills. Just wonder about the athleticism to actually be able to get guys open consistently, or whether he's just a guy who's going to be kind of out on the perimeter operating, making the right play, but not necessarily creating openings for players. And I think if that's what he turns out to be, that very much limits the ceiling of what he can be as a player.
Yeah, no, I agree, and that's kind of interesting. We're going to have Dean DeMarcus on, by the way, next segment too, so I want to ask him that same question as well, as kind of what he thought of the best and worst of Summer League. It'll be interesting to see his perspective. Okay, kind of going back to general NBA, obviously a lot of free agent moves this year. Want to ask you in particular about the Spurs, Warriors, Cavs group. And I almost want to play the Matt Moore game of the max trade for and wave, but I'll just leave it up to you. As out of right now, how would you rank those teams?
It's hard to not say that Golden State is still, I wouldn't say they're still the best, and maybe not the favorite, just simply because I think Cleveland has a leg up in terms of championship odds than everybody, because I don't think that anyone else in the East has really improved enough to not make that their race to lose, kind of. But as far as the best team, I don't see any reason to not think Golden State is going to be the best of that group again, even accounting for kind of some internal improvements from Cleveland a year in, and maybe better health from, I think that Kevin Love was probably hurt a little bit last year, and some internal improvements there just kind of coming together better. I still think that, you know, you're going to have to prove to me that Golden State, who is, you know, a borderline, if not clearly historically great team last year, who's bringing everyone of consequence back, why they shouldn't be considered the best team going in.
Yeah, and they were, you know, as you pointed out, historically good, you know. So even excellent teams from years past would maybe not be as good as next year's or last year's Warriors. You know, there's still... The Spurs and the Cavs still have something to show that they're at that level.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say the Spurs, I think, are getting... they certainly had a good offseason, and it's a very Spursy offseason in terms of kind of getting guys to fit into contract slots, to open up the ability to do things and stuff like that. And they certainly kind of retooled on the fly, but it's not a given that... you know, that LaMarcus Aldridge is going to be a seamless fit with them. I mean, you go with the you know, Greg Popovich will figure it out, and it'll work to some degree, but to the degree that all of a sudden they're instantly vault over, you know, a team that was significantly better than them last year, I don't know. And plus, you have to take into account that, you know, all their, you know, the main guys are all another year older, and it hasn't happened yet, but at some point, you know, Tim Duncan is going to be too old. At some point, maybe we've already started to see it, Tony Parker starts to decline. At some point, and he's flirted with it over the last couple of years, maybe Ginobili is just done.
Yeah.
So, and these are all, you know, things that, not knowing from the outset, you have to kind of take into account and say that, you know, if those all break San Antonio's way, sure, but that's a lot of big ifs.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. Is there anyone else in that belongs in that group of three? Rockets, Clippers.
You know, the next guys in the West are, you got to look at the Clippers. You got to look at the Thunder, although kind of their last move of the offseason, I guess not now since they signed Josh Houston today, but their last move of the offseason actually makes me think less of them, and I imagine we'll get to that. And the Rockets, they're all, if things come together, the Clippers certainly have upgraded their main weakness, which is their bench. They there's no way to look at them and say they haven't, you know, substantially upgraded their depth. And that, I think, was something that really hurt them in the playoffs. So maybe a step below, but they're right there too, if things break right.
Let's talk about that Thunder last move since you brought it up. I mean, I think you're on the side of that it's just too much and a bad move for the Thunder. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd go so far. I'd go a little beyond that even. I think I'll endear myself to your listeners by saying that I'm not a very big Enes Kanter fan at all. I think that they're actually losing stuff by having him on the court at the expense of Steven Adams and Serge Ibaka and Kevin Durant at the four and small lineups, and even giving, you know, taking away time from Mitch McGarry to develop. I think that has an effect of making them demonstrably worse on the floor, I think. So yeah, and if you know, the politics of the situation aside, which can't be discounted, because their A1 goal is keeping Kevin Durant, and if not matching that offer sheet, you know, exacerbates the appearance that they're cheap in such a way that, like, encourages him to go, then that obviously changes the calculus a little bit. But talking in terms of on the floor effect and their roster in terms of winning next year, I think you could make a strong argument that especially the amount they'll have to play him to kind of, quote, justify that contract, makes it worrisome to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely fair. I you know, I worry about, everyone talks about the defense, and I think that is really the major concern, but I also kind of worry about the offense as well. You know, he clearly didn't fit into Quinn Snyder's offensive system. I guess he fit into Ty Corbin's, but I don't know if that's a good thing, you know, in how post heavy Ty Corbin's offense was. And if Billy Donovan goes that same direction next season, that's just, in my mind, not the right way to use Russ Westbrook, Kevin Durant, Serge Ibaka.
Sure. And I think there's, you know, if there's a way to, you know, kind of have him be a primary offensive option for the 10-15 minutes a game that Durant, Westbrook are off the floor, then you kind of run a very post-centric game, then maybe that works. But that's, again, that's not a guy you pay $17 million a year to. That's a guy, you know, the question of, well, what if you just signed the qualifying offer? Well, not the qualifying offer. I think, you know, perfectly fine gamble for, which is his qualifying offer would, I think, have been around $7 million last year. And that's all of a sudden a very kind of, I don't want to say attractive, but that at least makes sense as that kind of bench scorer kind of guy.
Yeah.
And if that's what you're expecting from him, then, okay, you can quibble around the margins about the defense or if he's taking too many shots away from Durant or Westbrook or stuff like that. But as kind of a frontline player, I don't like it.
I always kind of thought that was maybe the best role, the bench scorer role for these kind of like bad defense, all offense bigs. I mean, I'm thinking of Al Jefferson too in particular here. You know, if you had like Al Jefferson as your bench scorer, that's actually kind of ideal, right? Because you don't need like a great point guard in order to get the ball into Al Jefferson on the block. You know, it's a pretty standard offensive efficiency that, you know, you're not going to out efficient Kevin Durant, but you might out efficient, say, you know, I don't even know.
Dion Waiters.
Yeah, Dion Waiters, for example.
Yeah, although I think there's like that the comparison is slightly unfair to Jefferson. Only insofar as, you know, Jefferson is topped out at his best times to be, you know, kind of a slightly below average to average defender. And that would be a sea change improvement, I think.
Yeah.
Any number of metrics will have Kanter, I don't want to say historically bad, because they don't go, many of the systems don't go back that far, but very disappointing. Especially relative to, you know, his peer group of centers in terms of defensive output.
Agreed. Kind of transitioning to the Jazz a little bit. First of all, the Jazz were spectacular defensively last year. You know this. You know, you looked at the rim protection stats with Rudy Gobert. I mean, they had a 94 D rating for the last 2 months of last season. That's, you know, that's really kind of unheard of in this era. Do you think they can be, you know, that good for a course of a season? You know, like, even if they regress, they're still a top two or three defensive team. Like, What do you kind of expect from this Jazz team, especially defensively next year?
I expect them to be pretty good. I don't expect 94 per 100 possessions. I think some of that is as teams are, as they show up on the schedule a little more, as a team, all right, you've got to be ready for these guys, which, you know, with expectations coming into the season, if they start the season well, then teams are going to look at ways to kind of get Gobert out away from the basket a little more and you know, finding the weak links, wherever they might be, you know, whether it's, you putting Trey Burke and Gobert's men in pick and roll repeatedly might be a profitable way, just thinking ahead of attacking them. You know, I think they're going to be a good defensive team, to very good regardless. I think that, the last 2 months of the season for a non-playoff team is often a trap heading into the next season that, oh, if they just keep this going, well,
yeah,
it's usually that they don't. Sometimes it does, and I think there will be a very good defensive team, especially if they kind of transition almost more to Hayward playing, as the quote-unquote point guard on offense and allowing them to kind of almost play Golden State-style defense with, three kind of 6-7 guys along the perimeter and then two very active big men along the baseline. I think that's a frightening, concept to try to score on, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of the promise of this Jazz lineup, and, especially with Dante Exum at the point, too, is you've got a tremendous length at all five positions. It's kind of Milwaukee Bucks-esque in that sense where you've got the length to slow people down. Exum showed a lot for me as a rookie defensive point guard last year, where you can imagine building a lineup of him and Rodney Hood and Gordon Hayward and Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert, and that's frightening because you really can switch to a huge degree.
Exactly, and also you have, with the Alec Burks, you have, you can cycle through a few more lineups. So that's something you can, with four guys for those three spots, you can do a lot of things with that.
If you were the Jazz front office, do you have a next step in mind, or is it just develop these players and see what happens, gather some more information and then make a decision then?
A little bit of that. I think that, to compete in the West, you probably need five kind of quality perimeter guys. And right now you kind of are pretty sure about Hayward. You feel pretty good about a couple of the other guys, but you don't know. And so it's kind of to see where you are. And then, maybe you do end up having to go and get a quote unquote true point guard or a 3-and-D player, to the extent that those guys are available, which is always questionable.
Right.
There aren't actually that many of them around. So I think a wait and see and don't rush unnecessarily is probably perfectly okay. I think as good as they might be this year, and I think they're definitely in the hunt for kind of a 7-and-8 seed, that's not something you kind of mortgage the future to go after, and I would hope that the fan base would be understanding of there's no need to rush because there's not a move that's out there that's going to make them a contender this year.
Yeah, I agree. And that's kind of what the idea of the front office is, let's figure out what we need and then go and get it then rather than try to get it now. I think the cost is less now, but you end up having the risk of acquiring the wrong sort of player with, say, your free agent cap space, for example.
Either that, or if you start to, going after established players and maybe you don't want to trade any of your core now, so you're spending future draft picks, and then if something doesn't work out, you end up having to set yourself back rather than gone forward. And I think that we've seen a lot of teams over the years kind of mistake where they are in the development and kind of, to use a poker analogy, just kind of push all in when they don't necessarily have the best hand.
Right, yeah. All right. What are you working on, by the way? Are there any studies we should look forward to? I mean, tell me what you have coming down your pipeline.
I just finished a couple things I was working on this week. I was looking at kind of a way to model passing efficiency for players and found some interesting stuff there. And then just kind of apropos of this conversation, I've kind of been tweaking and revamping the rim protection numbers and just starting to get into one of the, I think the big project I had, a couple big projects I had planned for the summer. One is to kind of, we talk about, you know, positions and players do this. We're trying to figure out what the hypothetical average small forward, NBA small forward, does these days across a number of metrics, and, you know, do that for all the positions. So, you know, when we're talking about how this guy fills those roles, the things that a specific player does or doesn't do, we can actually, you know, measure that a little bit instead of kind of doing some hand waving and saying, well, he's not a true point guard.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff. And the other is just kind of theoretically imagining what would the perfect data look like to tell me everything I want to know. That's maybe slightly more esoteric, but there's a lot of questions that people have that are very good questions that we just can't answer right now because we haven't collected kind of the underlying information that would allow those things to be brought to light.
Yeah, I think sometimes with statistical analysis, there's this tendency to like look at your toolbox to try to solve the problem rather than trying to invent tools to solve the problem, if that makes sense. You know, you've got these numbers in front of you. They must say something, but sometimes they're not the best numbers you can use, or sometimes you can have tweaks and that sort of thing in order to actually correctly answer the questions that are really important to, say, general managers or to NBA head coaches, that sort of thing. And I agree with you that I think we're kind of missing some of those metrics sometimes.
Yeah, and it's all about asking the right questions rather than kind of, I have this, like you said, I have this information, it must mean something. Well, what question does that answer?
Right.
And oftentimes some the analysis that, you know, the lying with statistics, line that people like to use is often, it's not lying, it's just, I'm picking the wrong information to answer the question I think I'm asking. So I'm giving a perfectly correct answer, just not to the question I asked.
Right.
And kind of that mismatch is what leads to a lot of kind of the results that people kind of, really? That doesn't make any sense about.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Well, we got to go ahead and take a break. But Seth, thank you so much for joining us. This is Seth Partnow, everyone. From Nylon Calculus and Washington Post Fancy Stats blog. Are those articles, by the way, those studies that you talked about coming out on Nylon Calculus, or where are you planning on publishing those?
The ones that I talked about were on one on each site, and the newer ones are going to be on Nylon Calculus, I think, the more general ones.
Cool.
And then up on Nylon Calculus.
Cool. Well, check it out, everyone, nyloncalculus.com. Thanks again so much for joining us, Seth.